Well, for the last several months, I have been in charge of scheduling speakers, pastors to come and share. And we've had such great pastors come and share from outside the body. And Pastor Ron and I have taken our turn this month in teaching. So we ended up with a Sunday where we didn't have a scheduled teacher. And we knew this quite a while ago. And then our new pastor. And so we had today, this Sunday. And so we thought, let's have testimonies. I was raised in a church. My father was the pastor, where testimonies were just a regular thing in the church. In fact, testimonies were mostly on Sunday nights. It saved my dad from preparing another teaching that day. And we had testimonies. Now, what we had, and maybe you're familiar with this, but we had what was called popcorn testimonies. And that is where someone would get up on a Sunday night and they would give a testimony. And then they would call on someone else in the congregation to give a testimony. That person had no warning that they were going to give testimony, but we were all to be prepared to always give a testimony in our church. So a person would get up, and they would give a testimony, and then they would just randomly call someone else. You know, usually someone who is trying to look like I'm not paying attention, you know, and go, "Oh, Val, get up and give a testimony." "Oh, no, I've had a rough week with Jesus." So anyway. So, and then that person would give a testimony, and then they would call on someone else to give testimonies. And so the thing really was, in the church I grew up in, that you should be prepared at any time to give a testimony. That's how we live. Now, the church has morphed or demorphed or whatever into, we don't have a lot of public testimonies. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 5, it says, "Always be prepared to give an answer." Always be prepared to give an answer. Now, that means to speak out loud a testimony. Always be prepared to give an answer, a testimony of the hope that is within you. Now, testimony simply means your story. This is your story. In Mark 5:19, Jesus said, "Now go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you." See, that's a testimony. Go home to your own people, to the people that you know and love and frequent with, and tell them what the Lord has done. That's what a testimony is to vocalize what the Lord has done. Now, if you're a Christian, you already have the greatest testimony ever. Where you were destined for the wrath of God, and God paid your substitute payment, and now you don't have a wrath coming at all. In fact, you've got nothing but glory. That is the greatest testimony of the years. But you also have hundreds more testimonies that happen daily, and they may not be huge, and they may be small, where God has intervened in your little old life and made his presence known. Now, I used to use a phrase, and got a little corrected on it, and I understand doctrinally, but I would say that a testimony was something that you recognize God showed up for. Okay? Now, God can't show up. You understand that? He's always here. He's never more here than he is always here. And so, but God made his presence known. We glorify God by telling others how God changed our life and continues to change our life. A testimony, no matter how big and in awe that thing is, like a miraculous testimony, a miracle, to the smallest simple things of God intervening in your life, always gives God glory. when I was a boy, I can remember these testimony services. And I can remember some of the testimonies were so wowing that you just go, oh my goodness. For example, I can remember a man that we laid hands on and prayed for because he was basically given a death sentence by his doctor. He was full of cancer. And so the church one Sunday night laid hands on him and prayed for him. The next Sunday was Testimony Sunday. He went to the doctor. He was totally, totally free of cancer. And we're all going, well, that's a big testimony. Whoa, 1 week prayer and he got healed of all cancer and he didn't die of cancer. I mean, he lived many, many years. So that's like, boy, God really showed up. And I heard testimonies where someone would say, I ran out of gas on the highway the other day and a kind gentleman came along, took me all the way into town, got a can of gas and drove me all the way back. Praise God. And so testimonies are your stories of God intervening. Now, other Christians want to hear your testimonies. Now, other Christians want to hear how the God of the universe that they put all their faith in somehow bowed down and touched your life. It gives us strength and courage that our God is alive and well. Now, your testimonies have power. Your testimony has power. It doesn't have authority, but it has power. Authority only is from the Word of God. But your testimony has power. Satan waged war against our king, his kingdom, and his kingdom kids. Waged war when Christ came out of the tomb, Satan waged war. And he's trying to bring down the king, the kingdom, and the kingdom kids. But when you give a testimony, you take back some territory. You take back some territory because when Satan hears you speak out your mouth, out loud to other people, what the king has done for a kingdom kid, that defeats Satan. Now, you can have all kinds of good things and God things that are going on in your life. And you do. We just need to recognize them. But when you vocalize it, you give God glory. So today is not about you. It's not about me. It's not about those giving testimonies. It's about giving God glory for showing up in our lives. Okay? Now, I'm the popcorn testimony is I'm going to give my own testimony of something that recently happened. Then I'm going to have Maxine come and share immediately after that. Then I'm going to have Larry Krogstad. And then I'm going to have Tom. Tom is Jody's brother. I think there's only one person here in the church that's had a full heart transplant, and that's Tom. And the Lord came down and touched him and gave him a new heart. Now, it didn't mean he had to ask Jesus in it again because it's a different heart, although I don't know. Maybe he needs to do that. I want to see him at the altar at the end of the service, just in case. But God reached down and touched Tom's life and not only provided a physical heart for him, he transformed his heart at the same time. And now he has a dynamic testimony. Then after that, we'll serve communion. Giving a testimony is a little bit like showing up in a court of law and being a witness. Now, you know I worked in the court for 10 years, and I've seen a lot of people take the witness stand. And what you do on the witness stand is you're bound by law and you're bound by an oath to tell the truth about what you saw or what you heard. And that's what a testimony is. We are telling the truth about what we've seen or what we've heard. Now, people can argue with the credibility of the Bible, whether it's real or not, but no one can argue with your testimony. Your testimony is your story. They can say, oh, the claims of the Bible, whatever. Well, let me tell you my story. And when you tell your story, no one can argue with that. You know, some people say, well, what do we do to get the younger generation in the church? And, you know, you got to speak their language. You got to use technology. Can I tell you what I think the most powerful tool of evangelism is? Your testimony. It absolutely is. So it's been said that a man with a testimony is never at the mercy of a man with an argument. Think about that. Let me say it again. It's been said that a man with a testimony is never at the mercy of a man with an argument. You cannot argue with your story. I want to put something on the overhead. Your testimony will never be what it is intended to be until we realize we no longer are what we used to be. You might want to ponder that. Your testimony will never be what it is intended to be until we realize we're no longer are what we used to be. So I want to share a brief testimony. So I think most of you know, because it's happened for years now, that I have a routine every morning, almost every morning. I get up and I drive to McDonald's, and I go through the drive-up window, and there I meet homeless people and all kinds of things, and it's just been a delight to do that. And then I go over to Safeway's parking lot and have my quiet time. That happens every single morning. Well, about 3 weeks ago, I was on my way to my routine, and I had an armful of garbage that needed to go out to the garbage. And I had my Bible, and I had my wallet in my hand. And so I went to the garbage can and just had too much, so I set my Bible and my wallet on my trunk of my car in the garage. And so I went over to the garbage, and I dumped the garbage, and I got back in my car, forgetting that my Bible and my wallet was on my trunk. So I backed out, didn't think anything, backed out and drove down the street, drove up the street, drove over to Powell, went down Powell, and I got, probably about a half a mile from my house or so, and I just happened to look at my rearview mirror, and my Bible, the pages were flying. You know, it was still on my trunk. Guess what wasn't on my trunk? My wallet. And so I got out and I thought, my wallet's gone. And can I tell you, we've all reached this point, but it was one of those days that I thought, Lord, I really don't know why you even allowed this to happen. I got so much on my plate and in my head going on right now that I just can't handle the thought of losing my wallet. It wasn't the money inside, but it was, you know, the driver's license, your ID, your credit cards, all that. And I got out there, and I tell you, my heart sunk. And I thought, I don't need this. I do not need this. And so I turned the car around, and I was going to retrace all the way back to my garage. And so I retraced, and I looked, and I saw nothing along the road at all. And I am now really getting desperate. I know it's not good for a preacher to beg and plead with God, but I was begging and pleading for my wallet. And Jesus, please give me my wallet. And so I got back, and there was nothing. I even so didn't want it to happen that I went inside and looked all over for my wallet in case I didn't put it out there. But I knew I'd put it on my trunk. And I drove back, and I tell you, I was pleading, and I said, Lord, if there's any way you can give me my wallet, I would love my wallet. And as I got just before the place I had noticed where my Bible was flapping, there was a woman standing along the road. And she had stopped in a van because cars had been running over my wallet. And money was just all over the place, okay? And credit cards, and my wallet was very crunched. And I got out, and she came over to the car, and she says, is this your wallet? I said, it is my wallet. I offered her money. She said, oh, no, no. And I want you to know, God showed up that day for me. I believe with all that I am, he returned my wallet to me. And I just want to praise him today, that he might get the glory for returning my wallet. you want to use this one. Okay.
He handed it to me, and I'm handing it back. A few months ago, I'm like Pastor, I was taking the garbage out to the garbage disposal at my apartment complex. And Julie, a neighbor of mine, had just recently had back surgery, and she was out walking a little bit. And so we were standing there talking. And all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, but we noticed this homeless man came down the driveway and around the disposal. And as he did, he asked me, he says, "Ma'am," he said, "is it okay if I put a little bit of garbage in the garbage dumpster?" And I smiled at him, and I said, "Well, I'm not the manager, but," I said, "as long as it's not a lot, that's good." And so he had a little bag, and he dropped it in the garbage or in the disposal, and then he came out. Well, as he came out, we got to talking. And I asked him, I said, "What was his name?" He said, "His name was Anthony." I said, "Anthony," I said, "how long have you been on the street?" And he said, "Well, about three and a half years. And I said, "Do you live around here?" And he said, "No." He said, "I make my home under the Sam Jackson Bridge," which is the bridge that goes on 205 from Oregon to Washington. And we got to talking about homelessness and just things in general. And it was amazing because he was very articulate in the way he talked. He was not a druggie. He was not, he wasn't, I don't know really why he was even on the street. But he was very dirty and very smelly. But there was just something about him, the look on his face that just, I don't know, have you ever just seen somebody and all of a sudden you just wanted to hug them? Well, we got to talking, and Julie got kind of restless because of her back surgery, and she says, "I have to go inside." And so she started to leave, and Anthony looked at me, and he says, "Oh," he said, "wait a minute." And I thought, okay, what's going to happen here? Because, you know, we have that fear of not trusting people totally anymore. And he took his knapsack off and laid it down on his little wagon that he had, and he got to digging through it. Well, pretty soon he comes up, and he looks at me, and the look on his face, there was a sadness that was beyond sad, a lostness that was beyond lost. And he handed me this little tiny doll, and she was absolutely filthy. She was so dirty and smelly. And he took it in his hands, and as I looked at his face, there seemed to be a connection between him and the doll. And I didn't ask him, I just didn't feel that I could, why the, you know, or what the connection was. But as he handed me the doll, I just looked at him and I said, "You know, Anthony," I said, "God knows your past. He knows your present, and he knows your future. And Anthony, God loves you." And I said, "Is it okay if I give you a hug?" Well, at this point, he looked at me like I'd thrown cold water in his face. And he said, "Max," he said, "I'm dirty." He said, I'm filthy dirty." And I said, "Anthony, you want to know something? You're not dirty." I said, "God does not look at your outward appearance. He looks at your heart." And I said, "Anthony, you have a good heart." I said, "Somewhere along the line," I said, "you've lost your way." I said, "You have forgotten that God will never leave you. He will never forsake you." And at that point, I gave him a hug. And he hugged me back. And he took his little cart, and he started to leave. And he kind of, yeah, he kept saying to himself, I have forgotten. And he went to the right, and I went to the left. And as I went to go back to my apartment, I held this little doll in my hand, and I looked at her. And what happened in me was, you're just as dirty. You're just as dirty as this little doll. You're just as dirty as Anthony, except for the grace of God. And that song we sang, his blood reaches to the highest and to the lowest. I took her home, I cleaned her. I got out the Clorox wipes, and I cleaned her, and I washed her dress. And she now sits on my dresser as a reminder of not only Anthony, but of Sam and Pamela and Heather and Sarah. All of these are homeless people that God has brought into my life. And I would leave you with a little poem that God gave me clear back in 1981. Do not judge, my little child, on what you see outside. Come, kneel before my mercy seat and see the heart inside. The heart that lies beneath is all that interests me. The attitude of each towards me is all I judge and see. Judge not, my little child, only know the heart beneath. That part of you and everyone is where I live and breathe. Know the heart, do not judge, and my love will reign supreme.
Good morning. I wanted to share with you my testimony and some events that has to do with my egg ministry that a lot of you know I do. My mind is a little scattered this morning, so forgive me for not being flowing very easy. I've been doing this for about 3 years now, and my ministry is growing more than double. I started out with a smaller chicken house, chicken run, and six chickens. And today I have two larger chicken houses, two larger chicken runs, and 14 chickens. And the people that I deliver eggs to has more than doubled, almost three times as much. So my story I want to tell you starts about a little over 2 months ago. And to set the stage, at that time I had eight chickens that were laying and eight baby chicks that were somewhere around 7 and 8 weeks old. And I also want to say that when I delivered my eggs, I would call a day ahead of time for the next day delivery for the people that were going to get those eggs to let them know that they were coming. And up until this point, pretty much all the time I've been having this ministry, I've never had anybody turn down the eggs. They were looking forward to having these fresh eggs. So starting about a little over two months ago, I walked out to take care of my livestock, and I found a dead chicken who died overnight, and that left me seven chickens. Fortunately, the eggs I was getting from these chickens were enough to deliver to the people that were expecting. But it wasn't longer after that that another chicken, she became a brooder and stopped laying. I don't know if you people know what a brooder means, but it's basically a chicken that sits on all the other chickens eggs and tries to hatch them. And it's not good to have one of those chickens around because it influences the other one, and they can pick that same habit up. Anyway, I tried to break her, and I couldn't do it, so I had to put her down. And a side note is God knows that that's one of the worst things I hated to do when having chickens, is having to put a chicken down. So he brought somebody into my life who took that responsibility off of me, where I didn't have to do it anymore. So here I am with six chickens, and the eggs they were giving me were not enough eggs to meet my obligation. So through the couple months, when I would call to let people know, and I was just at that point where I was not going to have quite enough eggs, somebody would say, I don't need my eggs today or tomorrow. I'm going out of town. I'm vacation. One person was in the hospital. But this happened off and on through this 2 month period. And then as fast as that started, it stopped, and everybody started wanting their eggs again. And now I'm back to, I'm sooner or later not going to have enough eggs. So if you remember, I had those baby chicks. And now at this time, these chicks were pullets. Pullet is a teenage chicken that are getting ready to lay, but not adult chickens. The timing at that precise time that I needed to get more eggs, one started to lay in very early. Brought me back to seven chickens that were laying, and now I had enough eggs, and I could sit back in my easy chair knowing that the other ones would follow. But it surprised me, because now, shortly after that, I got a phone call, and I had somebody wanted to be added onto the delivery list. Within days of that phone call, a second chick, younger chicken, she started to lay. I mean, the timing was just perfect. Shortly after that, a second person called, and the same thing. Another chicken started laying. And then a third person called. I'm going, what is going on here? I haven't had anybody sign up for my egg ministry for over a year. And this happened four times within a 2 week period. And in each case, each time, I had one of my pullets start laying. So if I was to put a title on this whole testimony, I would call it timing. God has provided for me. He has supported me, and he has helped me so much in being able to build these chicken houses, furnish me with the knowledge and people who have donated unsuspected money. I am so happy. And now, to put the icing on the cake, I've got now six of the eight of my younger chickens are laying. Now I can do something I really like to do, and that is I go out and I give eggs to the homeless. And I get to go out there and talk about God, and saying, what better way to go up and talk to somebody about God than saying, this is a gift from God. And by the way, do you believe in God, and have you accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? So that's my testimony.
To see a lot of you. Some of you I've met before, and some of you, a lot of new faces. As Val introduced me, as she's my sister, I want to share with you a little bit before I start. This morning, I prayed to the Lord that I hold it together. Looks like I'm already blowing up. And the second was for my words to give him glory. Because that's what this is about. When we talk to one another, we'll say things that we don't realize the impact of those words. And I want to share two things that were told to me 14 years apart by the same man, you, Val. In 2006, I was diagnosed with heart failure, and I was in Gresham Hospital, and took care of myself, exercised, kind of watched my weight, and this was something I never expected to hear. Had a 14-year-old son, you know, halfway through a career, scared and anxious. And Val mentioned to me that Tom, with this huge hospital, all this equipment, and all these doctors, your heart is not going to beat one moment longer than God wants it to. In short, God's in control. The anxiety level dropped. We're going to speed up now to just short of 14 years. Health has deteriorated drastically. It's deteriorated to a point where I sat in a chair, I looked out a window, and lived my life watching my neighbors live their life. To the restroom, it was about a 60-foot round trip. The end of that trip was holding against a wall, trying to catch my breath for about 4.5 minutes, generally followed by anywhere from a 20-minute nap to who knows how long. Denise and I had gone to the doctor. They said the medication and therapy are no longer working. We need to think of something else. And they have things called LVAD, inotrope, and then, of course, a heart transplant. You know, again, you know, it was a shock. It was a blow. I wasn't ready for it. Even though I knew I was sick and I knew things were going downhill, I thought the medication would somehow pull me through it. And obviously it did not. So they started doing some testing, and things got worse and worse and worse and worse. And another thing you told me one time is prayer moves the hand of God. I was a prayer, but no, I was not, because, you know, in so many ways, I felt like a hypocrite. You know, I called myself a Christian. I called myself someone who prays. I belonged to a growth group. Used to go to the Tuesday morning High Ground. And all of a sudden, I found myself sitting in that chair, watching videos of different pastors, praying, reading. Why is it when we're so near death that we worship God like we should when we're healthy? And I ask for forgiveness for that. So anyway, I went to the hospital. I was going in for a test. They said, you may have to stay, but you'll probably go home. It was July 6th. That was my birthday. They did what they called a right heart cath, and I was admitted to the hospital. I don't know how many of you understand about how the heart transplant system works. They talk about the list. This list is not a numerical list, okay? You're number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It doesn't work that way. You're categorized. The tests determine not only your blood type, but your size, your gender. So many things go into that test. It was 6 months of testing. 6 months of dragging myself into a car, having my wife have to drive me, wheelchair me in, wheelchair me out, take care of me, literally. Can't do anything. I can't even hardly make it to the restroom and back. So there I'm in the hospital, and you don't think things can get worse. They say, well, I was what they called a category 3. And they said, we're going to put you at category 7 because you wouldn't survive a transplant even if one was available. We're in the middle of COVID. And I said, okay. So I had what they called an Impella. And it's a device that is a surgery. You go in, it's a device that goes into the heart. And everything I'm telling you is pretty much layman's terms here, so I might be butchering it. But actually, it's a little propeller that creates centrifugal force, does the work of the heart, and pushes through. You have a thing called ejection fraction. It is a means for the doctors to test the efficiency of how the heart works. Our young people, their ejection fraction is going to be about 70, 75. Mine had plummeted down to 9, which barely kept my organs functioning. The Impella put me into a category 2, and anybody asked, what can you do for me? I said, pray. Pray. It's strange for me. I didn't pray to be healed. I didn't pray to God to say, God, let me live. I'm so deserving or something. I prayed for his will. I prayed for my family. I prayed for my friends. What would it be like to see my parents? So anyway, Val and Jody visited me. It was very hard to see someone in the hospital. I was in what they called CICU. It was cardiac intensive care unit. I don't even know if you used your clergy to get in, because most everybody that got in was either family or clergy. Pastor came, a friend of mine who is clergy, who actually I kind of work for now, but that's another story. And I said, just pray for me. And there was a doctor named Dr. Ott, and he was the assisting surgeon, done many transplants. He was a Christian. And there on my bed, I had a doctor praying with me. And I had about 3 nurses that knew. Prayer took so much anxiety and fear out of it. I knew a heart was coming. Didn't know, but Denise and I had actually kind of planned for my death. Jody and I inherited a house when they passed, and I kept part of it. And I sold it, and we started remodeling the house because I wanted the house to be set up. So I actually went in there not thinking the end was near. Maybe that's why I didn't pray for my healing. I don't know the answer to that. 16 days. My lead surgeon, Dr. Kamal Singh, I could tell you that name because it took me about 4 days to finally learn how to say it, said they thought they found a heart. And I said, is it a good one? He goes, yep, I think so. I said, let's do it. I'd like you to remember that part of it, if I remember to bring in the punchline. So it's going to be midnight the next night, because you don't get to reserve a surgery room. You know, you do it generally in the morning. So naturally, I didn't sleep. I was at Providence St. Vincent, which was really cool because they had ordained ministers on staff, and they came and prayed. Dr. Ott came in and prayed with me, and again, my prayer was for God to keep one hand on the shoulder of the surgeons and one hand on mine. That was my prayer. I remember the last thing, I don't know, it's 10 minutes till zero hour. I told Denise, it's a win-win situation. If I survive this, I get to grow old with you. If I don't, I'm at the feet of Christ. It's a win-win. I remember Dr. Holmes, he was the anesthesiologist, and any of us that's ever been before a doctor, you get to visit the anesthesiologist. And he said, would you like to have something to kind of relax you? And I said, you know, feeling pretty good, you know. Don't think I was all calm, cool, and collective. I mean, just don't get that idea in your head. But I didn't need, you know, some sort of an artificial something that relaxed me. When they wheeled me out of my room, the last thing I remember partially set up, I just kind of went like that to the knees. Goodbye. I mean, what kind of goodbye was it? Was it a goodbye forever or a goodbye when I wake up? I remember going down the hall. They lowered me down flat. I hate laying flat. I thought, oh, we're off to a great start. I don't know why. And the nurses, generally they'll have one person push it, but on this particular day they had like three or four pushing me. And I'm just laying there, and you watch the lights going by. And they're in their small talk. Not joking, but just kind of small talk. And I don't even know what it was about. I was kind of in my own thoughts. You go into that room, and boom, it's like 10 degrees colder. Everything's stainless steel. And all of a sudden, the whole environment has gone from casual talk to a very seriousness. And that seriousness brought a lot home for me. And they gave me oxygen, and all you hear is acronyms going off, talking about there must have been, I don't know how many people, because they start strapping you in. And a day and a half later, I woke up. They told me I'd have to learn to, you know, walk again, feed myself, dress myself. I thought it was a metaphor. It was anything but. Rehab, they tried to wait. They kept me under for a day and a half. They tried to get me to stand up for 4 hours after I'd come to. It wasn't pretty. Matter of fact, I didn't stand. They put a belt around you because your sternum is broken from here to here, cut. They flay you open, exposing all your organs, and then they go to work, removing your old heart and bringing in this other heart. My heart, the little bit we know, was 44. The heart age 37 year old. So we're putting a new carburetor with a blown engine. Anyway, died of drug overdose. It's amazing. They can actually clean a heart with hepatitis C now, and they call it an at-risk heart. So things were, anyone who's been on medication, I was on a drug, one of many drugs called prednisone. Prednisone has many side effects. It's a great drug, but it has many side effects. It can make you irritable, you gain weight, tremors, that sort of thing. And people often mentioned to me why I didn't get angry. And I often said two things. One is, you know, we're a family of faith. And two is, how can I get angry at someone trying to save my life? Things started happening quickly in my recovery. The prayers kept coming. Dr. Ott kept coming in. And COVID had gone full blown. They almost tried to keep Denise out. Kids got to come see me once in a while. You know, we're talking about a transplant as a blessing. You know, when you're sleeping hours upon hours. And your son drives straight from work in the morning and sits there for his four-hour shift, because you couldn't have two people, then Denise would come, just for you to wake up for 15 minutes to talk to you. Just sitting there, looking at his father. Yes, that's not a blessing. My recovery was quick. They call them numbers. I don't know what the numbers represented, but they said, your numbers are amazing. You're doing great. I started pushing myself. And as I started to go through the hospital, the ICU, I was going to say ICU. It's a special word for cardiology. But the nurses' stations are all along the hallway, and they're at their computers. And they're inputting everybody's medical information that the nurses see, because obviously I'm not the only one in there. And I just started walking. Now, when we talk about walking, we're not talking about a full 30-inch step at 120 beats a minute. Remember that, Ron? I'm sure you do. We're talking about, Tom, stand up straight. Keep your head up. Don't shuffle. Just walk. Okay, that's a miracle. And they wanted me to walk, and it takes 15 minutes to switch all the life support systems to battery operated to follow you with this IV pole. Looks like a Christmas tree. You got tubes that, anyway, you just have all kinds of tubes. And I remember walking down there, and there was this end of the walkway. We want you to walk up to there, and then we're hoping you can walk back. But if you can't, we're following you with a wheelchair. And if we tell you to sit, you sit. Because they're monitoring your heart rate and all your vitals and all that. And at the end of that walk, so I came out of my room, and I'm just kind of walking. And I'm just, and when I would walk, even afterwards, I wanted to walk alone. I really didn't hear people. I'm concentrating. I'm kind of praying and concentrating. I don't know if that makes sense. And all those nurses stood up and started applauding me. I was the first transplant through Providence at that time. And it was so overwhelming. And we got to the end of the hall, and if you went hard left instead of going around this barrier, it was about another 60 feet, and it came to some locked double doors. And for them, not for me, not for my family, for me, I started walking down that hall. And he said, Tom, you know, turn here. And I said, I can do this. I want to walk this. And I was walking for those nurses that stood up for me. And I remember, Denise, I always say how much I miss the old hymnals. You know, I love, you know, growing up, Woodstock Church of God, the old hymnals. And there was a song I loved, especially, What a Mighty God We Serve. If you guys know that, I don't know the rest of the words. Just what a mighty God, and I'm. It's about a 6'2". It's about a 30-foot walk, 30-40-foot walk each direction, and I'm just sitting there thinking that, just buried into that door, the grain of it, just singing, what a mighty God we serve. And I walked that, and I walked it back, and they're watching that monitor, because all they had to do is put me in that chair. I couldn't have resisted. Trust me. And in a way, that was a blessing, because guess what? The next day, that was part of my routine. We're not going to the end of the hall anymore. You're going out there. And I left the hospital several days earlier than they anticipated. The visiting nurse and the occupational therapist, they left about a week or two earlier than they anticipated. I was able to, our house has 7 steps up to the landing and then 7 more steps up. And that was my exercise. And I was being able to walk up and down that. And my house faces a cul-de-sac. And the first time I went out and went for a walk, I made it to my neighbor's mailbox. It took me 20 minutes to catch my breath. I wouldn't let Denise come with me. She could watch me. And the last time I walked that before I was set free was 26 laps. It was 3 miles. I wanted to walk 3 miles. And I made it to a mailbox the first time. Now, for a lot of people, they would say, you know, you recovered well, Tom. You did good. You pushed yourself. You showed initiative. I mean, I think non-believers would say that. There's generally a reason. You know, you're an exceptional or something like that. Anybody that knows me, I'm not exceptional, okay? Let's don't even go down that road. You know, we live with what we got. My medication, I start off at 59 doses of medication a day. Okay. The caretaker of any patient is the unsung hero. Pills. You got to take these 12 hours apart, but you can't take them within 3 hours of this medication because it'll knock down the immunosuppressants. But if you take this pill this time and this one this time, there's no way. You know, tonight when you guys are sitting at your dinner table, look across at the person who's going to be there for you. So I belong to a support group. I don't want to make this long. It's a Zoom, of course, because of today's pandemic. And they did the one-year stats. And they were kind of going over everything. And Providence has done 20 transplants. And I was the first one. Out of that 20, they have lost one. The other 19, I don't know where they are on the spectrum health-wise. But percentages, they were going down these percentages of what the percentage of the people who had issues with medication, allergic reactions or something. This is the amount of people who had to come in 1 to 2 nights, overnight stays. That was like in the 60 percentile. And they just gave all these different stats. I never had one of them. Not one. It's nothing I did. Nothing I did personally. There's no way. It's a blessing. It's God coming down and touching me. And I remember Chris, not my son Chris Green. He prayed with me and I said, God's keeping me alive for a reason. What is that reason? You know, and I hope I'm feeling that reason. I've gotten involved in some ministries. And I think at the start, there's some of it about doors opening or new doors opening. And I'm going to be honest with you, you guys have beautiful music. I sang halfway through a first song, and I just read the words, and I found myself coming apart again. I'm thinking, oh, this is not. Read those words to those songs. Don't just sing them. And I look at things so much different. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've sat in the house, looking out in the backyard, or some laughter that Denise and I had, or something, and I just say, thank you, God. Thank you. And I'll tell you something. One thing I do is were singing. You know, I heard Denise singing, I heard Jody singing, and, you know, Flood came back with you, sis, you know, growing up. I was getting kind of emotional. Of all things, I thought about when you took away my Tinker toy gun, and I dried right up. What it is last night or yesterday, I had three friends come over different times, just sitting in the driveway. We talk about bucket lists. People want to jump out of an airplane, or they want to go to a country, or they want to do something that's out of the normal, something daring. Right now, I'm getting to tell you, my testimony is a bucket list. My bucket list is to be able to not even think about it, to walk down these stairs, shake some of your hands, walk out to my car, get in my car, drive home, and be with my wife. Last night, we celebrated a granddaughter's birthday. To feel those hugs and to hear, "I love you," from that little voice. That's my bucket list. Because, you know, blessings are so temporary. I talked about Christopher. I mean, got sent to the principal office in preschool. Impossible, but, and there were many, many trips to Brother Robert's office. He gets in trouble. I got to see the principal, but that was a blessing, and it's gone forever. I'll never get that little boy back. You know, grandchildren and stuff. You know, we talked about the box. Our son Christopher is driving back from Idaho right this minute as I'm speaking. This little box can contain a phone call, and that blessing is nothing but a memory. I hug him hard. I hug him so hard. Yeah. I love you, sis. I think, I don't recommend to go to what I do, but our blessings are not heart transplants and stuff. Our blessings is our family. Our blessing is the love we have for one another. That has been my